Britain's government just got caught lying and imprisoning people that speak the truth. They've been going after Twitter. They've been threatening to arrest and jail Elon Musk. And now we know that all of that is to try and not stop the spread of misinformation, but to stop the truth from getting out. We'll also give you an update on Israel's strike against Iran and the state of the Middle East on today's Trumpet World. You probably remember the tragic stabbing attack in Southport on July 29th when Axel Rudakabana stabbed three very young little girls to death and injured several more at a children's dance class. And his stabbing spree shocked the nation. It triggered protests across the country. And we got a lot of lies about it from the mainstream, and we got a lot of people being in a lot of trouble, arrested and now even imprisoned due to what the government claimed was misinformation. Initially, the press reported that Axel was a Welsh boy. They covered up the fact that he was the son of immigrants. And then things escalated from there. Some of the protesters, as well as then some Muslim counter-protesters, got violent. People across the country were arrested for spreading the misinformation that was supposedly responsible for the violence. The BBC blamed these riots, as they were called, on, quote, false online rumors that the suspect in the Southport attack was a Muslim. And people were arrested for spreading these alleged rumors. Wayne O'Rourke, for example, he was jailed for 3 years for, and again, quoting the BBC, alleging it was a terrorist attack carried out by a Muslim. Well, yesterday, police revealed that O'Rourke and these others that were jailed for misinformation were telling the truth, while the government and the media were the ones actually spreading misinformation. Rudakabana owned an Al-Qaeda training manual. He was indeed a Muslim, and he had been manufacturing ricin, a deadly toxin. He's been charged with terrorism offences. He's been charged with offences under the Bioweapons Act. And think about what just happened here. The government lied. And then, you know, a government locking people up for what they say online is sinister enough, but they were locking people up for telling the truth. Those people that said that this individual, this Axel guy, was a Muslim, were right. It is the police and the Crown Prosecution itself that are now alleging that Axel was a terrorist. That's what he's standing trial for now, for being an Islamist terrorist. You know, what the BBC called false online rumors were true. And the government likely knew that it was true. Dominic Cummings, he used to be right at the top of the government, a key advisor to Boris Johnson. He's been all over Twitter on this, saying, well, the Prime Minister would have been informed about all of this almost immediately. Now, remember, we have seen the government, we've seen the Prime Minister himself make threats against people as high up and as hard for the British government to reach as Elon Musk. I mean, remember this?
And let me also say to large social media companies and those who run them, violent disorder clearly whipped up online, that is also a crime. It's happening on your premises. And the law must be upheld everywhere. That is the single most important duty of government. Service rests on security, and we will take all necessary action to keep our streets safe.
You also had people like the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, the head of London's police, basically threatened to extradite and imprison Elon Musk. Kind of nuts, but this is what he said.
We will throw the full force of the law at people. And whether you're in this country committing crimes on the streets or committing crimes from further afield online, we will come after you.
Talk to me about that, because we have seen some high-profile figures whipping up the hatred. You talked about it in there with the officers, in fact, about this being added to by online commentary. I mean, I'm even thinking of the likes of Elon Musk getting involved. What are you considering when it comes to dealing with people who are whipping up this kind of behaviour from behind a keyboard, maybe in a different country?
Being a keyboard warrior does not make you safe from the law. You can be guilty of offences of incitement, of stirring up racial hatred. There are numerous terrorist offences regarding the sort of publishing of material. All of those offences are in play if people are provoking hatred and violence on the streets, and we will come after those individuals just as we will physically confront on the streets the thugs and the yobs who are causing the problems for communities.
So you had the top of the police and you had the Prime Minister saying, you let people talk freely about this and we'll say that you're encouraging riots and we'll lock you up. Elon Musk followed by tweeting, I don't think anyone should go to the UK when they're releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts. And he was threatening to pull out of a business conference. I think he did ultimately pull out on that. I mean, based on that government rhetoric, you could see them arresting him if they got the chance. And all of that, again, just arresting people for online discord is bad enough. Now, again, we know they wanted to arrest Elon Musk, and the Prime Minister was making that speech all while knowing that these false online rumors were true. All while knowing that all of this discourse that Axel was a Muslim, that Axel was a terrorist, you know, knowing that the police were going to come and allege exactly the same thing. And he's not been tried in a court of law yet, of course, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But they went and arrested people in the UK for telling the truth while they knew it was the truth and while they were going and accusing them of lying. You know, they were using the police force to cover up the truth. And this has got to be one of the biggest attacks on the truth, on honest reporting, on the media that we've seen from a British government. And it's absolutely, absolutely shocking. And of course, not everyone that they arrested was arrested purely for speech crimes. There were some genuinely bad things that happened. You know, I am not talking about the police arresting people or attacking or condemning the police, criticizing the police in any way for arresting someone for, say, trying to burn down a hotel. You know, that's something that allegedly happened during these riots. Clearly, if somebody's trying to burn down a hotel with migrants in it, they're trying to destroy a hotel, they're trying to kill people, they should be arrested, they should be charged, they should be jailed for that. So, yeah, you know, when I'm talking about the police going after their enemies for what they're saying, I'm not talking about them arresting genuine arsonists. That should be happening. What should not be happening is arresting people for saying Axel was a Muslim terrorist, because now the police are saying, hey, here's all this evidence that he was a Muslim terrorist. And you know, normally, those accused of a crime, they could wait years for a trial. Justice is very, very slow. Even if you can call it justice these days, the justice system, it's more of an injustice system. But normally, people, they have their lives on hold, they're sitting around, they're waiting for ages for these court cases. But those accused of spreading misinformation, boom, you know, they were fast-tracked into trials and fast-tracked into jails. Many of them were pressured into pleading guilty. I mean, it was part of this fast-track because the government knew evidence was about to come out that would show that they were right. And they would have a much harder time jailing them for spreading misinformation if it was about to be made public that that misinformation was true. Were they coming along trying to lock these guys up before the truth came out? I mean, that really seems like what they were doing. And even the timing of when they finally did release this information is significant. Right now, today, Britain's new government is announcing its very first budget. And for the last few weeks, speculation about tax rises and what the new government's spending priorities are going to be, that's kind of been front page news for weeks. There's been a real build-up to this day of what this new budget is going to look like. They wanted to bury this announcement. They deliberately had this released the afternoon before the budget because they want to get it out of headlines. They want to bury it. They're still trying to cover this up. And then, despite being caught out here, they are also trying to still crack down on speech. They're still trying to go after people that speak the truth now that they've admitted that it's the truth. And the situation of this Axel Rudakabana, he is being charged under terrorism offences. But the police are saying, well, and the Crown Prosecution Service, we don't know the motive for the stabbing attack. We know that he had an Al-Qaeda training manual. We know that he was manufacturing ricin. We are trying to imprison him under the Terrorism Act. We are accusing him of being a terrorist. But we don't know whether the stabbing was a terrorist attack. That is the official government line now. Because they're saying, well, we don't know what motivated that particular attack. Maybe, even though he was trying to be a Muslim terrorist in this other area and had a terrorist training manual, Maybe something else motivated the stabbing. And so they're threatening to go after people even now, even after all of this, that say he was an Islamist terrorist or that this was an Islamist terrorist attack with this, but technically we think he was a Muslim terrorist that carried out an attack, but we don't think that this was a Muslim terrorist attack. Anything to get political opponents in prison. They're also using the fact that this individual is about to be tried. He's yet to be tried to squash speech. You know, police and politicians came out and they called those people that they accused of spreading misinformation. They called them far right. And they did that despite the fact they hadn't stood trial yet. Now they're saying, well, this Axel Wohler came out. You can't use any language that would condemn him or criticize it because he hasn't faced trial and it wouldn't be fair. Again, two-tier standard of justice. You can say all the negative things you like about these people the government was trying to imprison before they stood trial. That's absolutely fine. But you can only say nice things about Axel Ruder Cabana and be very careful you don't call him a murderer. Make sure you say alleged murder. He may have been caught at the scene of the crime. There may be no doubt that he was the one that stabbed those little girls, but we've got to be incredibly careful about what we say about him before this trial. It is just such a shocking attack on speech, the way that they want to stop you even condemning things. And this is easily the biggest story right now. Yet the BBC didn't put this on their top story. If you're watching BBC News last night, I think it was only 20 minutes in or so to the news show that they actually got round to talking about this. And then today was also Prime Minister's question time, the time for MPs to question the Prime Minister about the things on their minds of their constituents. And the Speaker of the House of Commons stepped up and said, no, you cannot ask about this. Again, using this very thin upcoming trial excuse, saying nobody can ask the Prime Minister any questions about the Southport stabbing. It's absurd. You can ask the Prime Minister questions about who knew what and when did he exactly know that the police had discovered an Al-Qaeda training manual at his house? When was he informed? You could ask the Prime Minister that. That doesn't in any way prejudice the trial. Did you know this when you fast-tracked people into prison? Was this why you fast-tracked people into prison, so you could get them locked up before the truth came out? That doesn't prejudice in any way at all Axel Ruder Cabana's trial, but it's an excuse to cover this up. I mean, seeing this story, it really brings some words from Isaiah 59 vividly to life. And this is from the New Living Translation. And here it says, our courts oppose the righteous and justice is nowhere to be found. Truth stumbles in the streets and honesty has been outlawed. Yes, truth is gone and anyone who renounces evil is attacked. And that's Britain today. Honesty has been outlawed. You can't speak the truth about the Southport stabbing attack or you risk arrest. And a lot of people are rightly angry about this. But Isaiah continues again with the New Living Translation. The Lord looked and was displeased to find there was no justice. And God is displeased. God is angry with a government that fails to protect its own citizens and then prosecutes those that speak out about a danger. Prophesies those, God says, sound the trumpet, blow an alarm. If you see a danger coming, you need to warn about that. And now we have a government that says, no, if you talk about that, we are going to send you to jail. It is really revealing how many Bible prophecies talk about rampant injustice, rampant lying from authorities. It's going to get worse. You see this in Britain. You see this in Canada. The Telegraph over the last week or so, they've just had a fantastic series of trying to expose for the British public what's going on in Canada. How bad it's getting there. I mean, these are countries where it's becoming very hard to speak the truth. And governments actively trying to make it harder for churches to operate, criminalizing statements that they don't like as hate crimes. And you see more and more restrictions, even in the United States, despite the First Amendment and the protection that provides being brought on there. But Isaiah 59 is such a revealing chapter about this trend. And I said many other biblical scriptures talk about it too. And it helps us understand why. If we look at the start of the chapter, I'll go back to the King James Version, Isaiah 59 and verse 1 says, "Behold, the Eternal's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither is his ear heavy that it cannot hear." You know, why is God allowing this? Surely he's powerful enough, he could step in. If God is angry about what is happening, well, why doesn't he stop it? Well, verse 2 says, "But your iniquities, your sins, your lawlessness," that's what that means, iniquities, "your breaking of God's law, breaking of the Ten Commandments, have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you that he will not hear." God could step in and save us. He could have saved us already from these unjust courts, from people being prosecuted for telling the truth. Now, yeah, we do talk about God intervening in world events. We do talk about him very soon providing some temporary stability to let this message go out. But also, he's going to let things get a whole lot worse. And in fact, this chapter talks about God even adding on curses. Well, why? Because of our sins. And yes, yep, there are evil governments. Yes, there are evil people in power, but God could take care of that. And we need to look at ourselves too. We need to look at the laws that we're breaking. That's another important part of this. God is allowing this. I mean, yeah, we see a lot of people outraged by what is happening here. Do you see many people in Britain crying out to God for help? Do you see many people in Britain even talking about, well, we need to get back to truth? It's rare even for people to say, we need to get back to Britain's traditions and that Britain is traditionally a Christian country. Now, you know, Satan is the god of this world. The vast majority of people are deceived, and that includes the vast majority of religious and even Christian people. So I'm not saying that is the solution. You're getting back to a traditional British Christianity. There's still things that teaches that are lawless, that are at odds with the Bible. But you don't even see, my point is that people are not wanting to change. You don't see a widespread yet desire to change and a desire to say, well, we've made mistakes. Not just that there's a few bad people in government, but we need to make some fundamental changes in society and in ourselves. You know, God will intervene, but God isn't intervening, so we learn that lesson. We look at verse 16. It says, "And he saw there was no man and wondered that there was no intercessor." You know, there's no human that can save us. There's no human that is going to, again, God works through men, but there's no individual that is going to lead the nation to repentance. So it says, "Therefore his arm brought salvation unto him, and his righteousness, it sustained him. He put on righteousness as a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation upon his head, and he put on the garments of vengeance for clothing, and was clad with zeal as a cloak. According to their deeds, accordingly he will repay fury to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies. To the islands he will pay recompense, so they fear the name of the Eternal from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun." God is going to intervene, and God is going to punish, and he's going to help us see our sins and change. And so that's how this chapter details a whole lot of evil. It's a great chapter to read to describe our society, but it also describes the solution. If we look in verse 20, it says, "And the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgressions in Jacob, says the Eternal. As for me, this is my covenant with them, says the Eternal. My spirit that is upon you, and my words which I have put in your mouth, shall not depart out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed seed, says the Eternal, from henceforth and forever." God is going to come and bring eternal salvation to all of this world. And he's going to allow things to get worse. He's going to bring correction. And then when we're willing to listen and confront those sins, well, he's going to bring salvation to the world. God will save Britain and America. And a great place to learn more about this and about God's plan for Britain, for America, for the whole world. I mean, Britain and America are countries that God has worked with in the past. And because of that, they receive some even more direct, intense, and special correction. And so because of that, they receive a more direct, intense warning ahead of that correction. But God ultimately is using Britain and America as a tool to reach out to the whole world. And to learn more about that, a great place to start is Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That is a book that contains, as Mr. Armstrong said, the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. It is at the same time the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God. You know, it shows you that there is a God there that has not forsaken the earth, that is not just unconcerned with what is happening here. He sees what is going on in our nations, and he has a plan to deal with it, and a plan to bring all of mankind into his family. That ultimately is what this book is all about. And you can read that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can download it. You can order your own free print copy. We'd be very happy to send that to you for free, and you can do that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, while we've had a little bit of a break here, there's also been some dramatic events in the Middle East to catch up on. We'll take a quick break, and we'll get into those in just a moment. A lot has been happening while we've been taking a short break, and a lot of that in the Middle East. One of the most dramatic has been Israel's direct attack on Iran. Here to tell us more about it, I'm joined by our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. So, Mihailo, what went on with Israel's strike?
Well, the details are still murky, but what we do know is that on October 25th, the Israeli Air Force sent dozens of warplanes, including F-35s, F-16s, some of these most advanced warplanes ever invented, over 1,000 kilometers away from home, through Syrian airspace, through Iraqi airspace, to attack certain Iranian military targets. This is in retaliation of a ballistic missile barrage of over 180 missiles that Iran sent Israel's way back on October 1st. Israel has for a long time said that they were going to retaliate, and that they were going to retaliate in a very significant, meaningful way. Why it's taken so long, we'll get to a little bit later in the program. But suffice to say, Israel finally kept its promise, and in a very significant way, in a number of ways. For again, the details are exactly murky on whether they fired their missiles from Iraq and then returned home, or actually entered Iranian territory. But if they did, this would be the first time Israel has ever entered Iran with formal troops. In this case, the Air Force, of course. It also, there's at least four sites around Tehran that were struck down, including the city's international airport. So the fact that Israel was able to get all the way close to the nerve center of the beast, so to speak, says a lot about not just Israeli determination and what they wanted to do, but also Iran not being able to intercept them, unlike, say, how Israel intercepted the barrage they received earlier in the month. They also hit various sites throughout the country, including on the Persian coast, sending the message that Netanyahu famously said in his United Nations speech not that long ago, that no matter where you are, we will find you. In this case, he has demonstrated that Israel can hit any part of Iran they wanted to, apparently with impunity. Now, what exactly these targets are? Well, one of the most significant ones is that Israel destroyed at least four Russian S-300 systems. These are a Russian system that Iran has purchased because they most of their equipment is from the days of the Shah and is aging, so they're trying to upgrade their technology. And in this case, Israel took out one of the most advanced weapons in their arsenal that they've acquired in recent days.
Right, this is Russia's most advanced air defense system. Correct.
Not only that, but this was the majority of Iran's own air defense systems left. So it was made for like long range attacks, like what Israel did. But now Iran only has short range missiles mostly left to intercept anything that would come Israel's way. And if Israel could deal with the advanced systems this way, it's going to make short work of these other systems too. And on top of that, you combine with the fact that Russia is tied up in its own war in Ukraine. It needs its own systems for its own purposes, and Iran is probably not going to get resupplied anytime soon. According to sources speaking with Axios, with some of the defense complexes that Israel hit, pardon me, they also hit what Axios sources call 12 planetary mixers. I guess you could call it a centrifuge-type device that's actually used for creating fuel for ballistic missiles, like the ones that hit Iran on October 1st. These ones are not indigenous to Iran, like the S-300s. They're, in this case, imported from China, And these are pretty sophisticated machines that Iran doesn't really have the technological expertise to make indigenously, and some Israeli sources estimate it could take up to a year to get the replacements for these. So either way, Iran doesn't really have the capability anymore to launch a barrage of attacks like it did on October 1st, at least in the same kind of intensity. So with these, just with these factors alone, not only has Israel taken out Iran's indigenous air defense systems, but they've also basically neutered Iran's capability to repeat what happened on October 1st. That's not the most important target Israel hit. That would be the Parchin military complex, which is about 30 kilometers southeast of Tehran. Again, pretty close to the capital, but what's significant about this center is, well, first off, it helps construct some of those missiles, but even more importantly, it is most likely an undeclared nuclear site. It was a nuclear site about 20 years ago, and Iran had since then said its only uses for conventional military purposes, and because of that, it was outside the limits of what the United Nations could inspect when the 2015 nuclear deal was on. It's credible intelligence suggests it's still a nuclear site, but the fact that it's undeclared compared to some of their other sites like Fordow or Natanz suggests that maybe there was even some more advanced work going on there than even what some of those declared sites were doing. From satellite imagery released by Planet Labs, we know that at least four buildings in that complex were significantly damaged. And again, the details are murky. We don't know exactly what was going on in there. But Israel could have theoretically bumped Iran's nuclear program down a notch just with a strike on this one facility.
So these are some significant strikes. We also know, though, the United States has put a lot into holding Israel back to the point of even maybe accidentally on purpose leaking Israel's strike plans to the Iranian government. So you know, how much has this been held back, do you think, by the Biden administration?
Well, for one hand, as I mentioned earlier, it's taken a long time for Israel to do this retaliation. And one of the reasons is the U.S. government, the Department of State, has publicly stated Israel cannot attack anything to do with Iran's nuclear facilities or Iran's oil facilities, which, I mean, you know, these are U.S. weapons. It's not like it's not illogical for the United States to have a say in how they're used. But A, why those two? And B, why is it saying it publicly? Why is it saying a statement for the whole world to see that Israel can't back out of, or America could let Israel save its face? We've covered a lot on this program, including in an article I wrote last year about how the U.S. has worked pretty hard to work with Iran in developing a new nuclear program or nuclear deal, and has protected Iran from the international community and especially from Israel in keeping its nuclear program up and going. I mean, this is Iran we're talking about. This is not Switzerland. It's pretty obvious why they want the a nuclear program going, and
why this oil-rich country wants
Yes,
they're not short of energy resources.
Yes, exactly. And I guess you could say the elephant in the room is that the U.S. wants to come to a deal to that Iran could stay in power and keep doing what it's doing, etc. But they didn't want to say it outright. They would hide under like sanctions that are not enforced or whatever. In this case, this is a blatant statement. We don't want Iran's nuclear program hit. Even though it would, for any sane-minded person in any position in the free world, this would obviously have everything for the West to benefit and nothing for the West to lose from this. The oil facilities, I mean, Iran is a petrostate for all intents and purposes. You hit the oil, you're going to bankrupt them immediately, and that means stopping funding for Hezbollah, that means stopping funding for Hamas, all these other proxy groups. If Israel was given the leeway to attack some of these areas, the war could probably be over tomorrow. I mean, there's other considerations too. Most of Iran's oil goes to China, and Israel doesn't necessarily want to make China mad. But at the same time, if you want to end the war, let Israel end the war. America handcuffing Israel like this, including with leaked intelligence documents that we'll get to in a moment, shows that America does not want Israel to go in and give the coup de grace. America wants, and I mean, even the Hezbollah war, they try so hard to let to stop Israel from doing this. They tried so hard to stop Israel from the ground invasion in Gaza. America's foreign policy in general since October 7th was to try to bring back the October 7th status quo. Again, even though we're talking about jihadi groups that have killed plenty of Americans, that are still having America and the countries in the West in their crosshairs, and America's still going out of its way to try and keep them still afloat.
And of course, even before October 7th, it was America's lifting of sanctions on Iran that made it easier for Iran to get missiles and things like that to Hamas. And I mean, they've been giving missiles to Hezbollah for a long time, but it's made it much easier for Iran to do that. They've given Iran access to vast amounts of money that Iran has then plowed into Hamas and Hezbollah. I mean, in a very real way, the Biden administration helped enable October 7th. But with this latest round of attacks, they've had, I think, this dilemma. I don't feel sorry for them, but they've been in this situation where they want to protect Iran. They have shown that for years now for the Obama administration, and then basically for what's effectively an Obama third term during the Biden administration, that they want to empower Iran. And doing that means holding back Israel. But they're doing it right before an election in this case. If they're too obvious about it, you know, that's really going to hurt them in November. Mm-hmm. Empowering Iran is not, siding with Iran over Israel is incredibly unpopular to everyone but the most radical of Democrats. So they've had to try and be a bit quieter about how they do this. And that's probably limited how much they could even hold Israel back in this case.
Yeah. And in this case, I think that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's response on how he conducted the attack is pretty impressive. I mentioned Parchin, like, it's a nuclear site. There was a line drawn in the sand.
Yep, that's right. America said don't attack nuclear sites.
But America doesn't acknowledge that site as a nuclear site. So if America was to point the finger at Israel with that, they would have to admit that they've been lying and covering up.
It's not a nuclear site. Yeah,
yes, exactly.
Iran says it's not a nuclear site. It's fair game.
Yes, exactly. And I think, especially now that Netanyahu's had 12 months of experience in the war, he's sort of figured out what he can and can't get away with. I think, especially in the election year, as you mentioned, I think he is playing the Democrats' demands and rhetoric to his own advantage. But that doesn't negate necessarily everything that has happened so far. There's been reports from Reuters, for example, of Secretary of State Antony Blinken telling European American allies and Arab allies that they are literally trying to contain Israel's response, and that, don't worry, we are going to keep everything under control. Israel has to respond to this, but we're going to put them on as short of a leash as possible. I mean, for any other country in the situation, I mean, you can't imagine them saying that about Ukraine, or at least not publicly, or not pretending like it's the right thing to do. But with Israel, they can get away with it. And to go into the leak, finally, that you mentioned, on October 18th, this is probably the biggest revelation, I guess you could say, as to what's going on behind the scenes. There was an Iranian Telegram channel called Middle East Spectator. We don't know too many details about who they are, but they say they're from Iran and they publish all sorts of pro-IRGC content. And somehow it got a hold of U.S. intelligence documents. This supposedly private channel in the Middle East got a hold of documents that were collected by the Department of Defense and shared throughout the intelligence community about geospatial data of where Israel was potentially planning on attacking, even some details as to the training of the Air Force and drones that Israel could have used. How this got into Iran's hands, we don't know. It could have been maybe one rogue, disgruntled person. With everything else the administration has shown, including what we've talked about on a program back in September.
Right, I was going to say, or it could have something to do with this entire program that you and I did on Iranian spies that have been invited right into the heart of the Biden administration. I mean, this is why I say it looks very accidentally on purpose leaked to Iran. If you are knowingly employing known Iranian spies, which is what the Biden administration is doing, it looks very like you wanted this information to get out.
Occam's razor, simplest explanation is the best. But not even just the fact that this information got out. There's a lot of questions as to how the U.S. got this information in the first place. The day after the Telegram channel put up its the documents, Axios came out with an article where they claimed, quote, The report, if accurate, would suggest very close and detailed surveillance by U.S. intelligence of Israel's preparations for an attack on Iran, including the use of satellites to spy on operations carried out at Israeli Air Force bases, end quote. Again, with so few details, there are plenty of dots we can't necessarily connect, but I mean, if this is true, that means that the U.S. went out of its way to spy on its ally. Not necessarily even just handing information the Israelis gave them to Iran, but to spy on an ally and then give the information to Iran.
Really is remarkable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's not just... I hadn't heard that before, but if it's not just being careless with what they've already been given, but they're actively spying on Israel and then passing that information on to Iran. And whose side are they on in this conflict?
Exactly. And I think it's also telling that apparently Israel also warned Iran ahead of time of where it was going to strike the day of. Again, according to Axios, supposedly they used intermediaries like the Dutch government to bring the message across. That's not something a country from a position of strength that wants to tell somebody to back off, to put the brakes on a bit. I mean, yes, you could argue that maybe they're just trying to de-escalate the situation and stop the regular retaliations that everybody's giving to each other. But, I mean, Israel, again, Prime Minister Netanyahu has made it very clear his goal is not to bring back the status quo. His goal is to end the war and to end the war on the high ground. And I don't think he would have done that if it weren't for American pressure.
So to get back to this point, I mean, here's my take, I guess, on... how significant are these attacks? I'm curious if you agree. Israel, I mean, it seems like this could have been even more. This could have been even bigger. It could have been even more crippling to Iran. Israel did kind of the best of what they could within the US boundaries. And what they ended up doing feels to me as much like a message as an attack, where they've gone in there and they've demonstrated, hey, Iran, we can hit anywhere in your country. The latest Russian missiles and defense systems aren't going to protect you. We can hit your secret nuclear sites. Yes, we've done I don't want to downplay the damage that they've done already, but a lot of that seems to be as well a message about the further damage that Israel could do if Iran keeps pushing.
Well, and tying in with the election year, I mean, most people are expecting Donald Trump to get back into the White House. He is very much, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say he's an Israeli flag waver, but arguably he was the most pro-Israel president in America's history. And you think about attacks like the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and some of his other maximum pressure campaigns against Iran. Israel and Iran both know that what Israel can do in this conflict is limited by what the United States says, for good reason. I mean, that's where they get most of their weapons. That's their only ally in the United Nations Security Council. Israel can't poke the bear too much. But the bear is there's going to be a new sheriff in town in Washington, most likely very soon. And Iran knows that if Trump comes back in, it's most likely Israel's open season. And it might very well be a warning that your days of doing whatever you want are going to be numbered very soon, and so you better start cleaning up your act before then.
So if we see a Donald Trump victory this next week, especially, we could see a much more chastened Iran, at least temporarily. But I think we've also had some interesting pieces of news just this week that show that fundamentally, whatever Iran does kind of tactically to navigate the US political system, they're not changing. I think it was it today or yesterday, we had an Iranian government spokesman come out and say Iran is going to triple its military budget. So they're doubling down there. They executed a German citizen or a dual Iranian-German citizen that they basically kidnapped from the United Arab Emirates, and they put him to death on Monday. Maybe they won't poke Israel for a little bit while we've got Donald Trump in office. Fundamentally, the leopard's not changing its spots.
Of course not. I mean, fundamentally, the leopard has been in control of Hezbollah and Hamas for all these decades, regardless of whether Trump or Obama or whoever was in power. And maybe this current war is the largest escalation of this, but there's been a shadow war against Israel since there's been an Islamic revolution. And, I mean, different politicians in Iran obviously think differently and want the country to go in different directions, but fundamentally, the country is a lot more ideological than, say, most of the world's great powers, and most of what they're driven to do is not so much out of strategic concerns, or strategic concerns as an end and up to themselves, but for their religious desire for like a worldwide Islamic revolution. And Israel, arguably even more so than the United States, is the biggest obstacle standing in their way, even taking aside the religion's importance of Jerusalem, which of course is fundamental to their worldview as well. But even if that wasn't the case, for Iran to achieve their goals, they need to get rid of Israel, and specifically they need to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu.
I think that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, that this is a very different regime. This is an Islamist regime. This is a regime where Iran is a Shiite country. I think about 85% of Iran Shiites belong to this really a mainstream branch of Shiite theology called Twelvism, that believes then in a return of the 12th Imam, a return of this Muslim leader, basically, that they can hasten the return of this individual by triggering war and chaos, and particularly religious war. So this is a country that actively wants to promote chaos. And this is even behind their nuclear program, that most countries, you can kind of, we've done fairly well on mutually assured destruction. Soviet Union has missiles, America has missiles, they don't send nuclear missiles at each other because they know that if they do that, both sides would be wiped out. When you have a religious fanaticism, that equation stops working. And you have an Iranian regime that believes that they can usher in the return of Muslim paradise at the hands of this 12th Imam. Now we're looking at things very, very differently. So I think that is an important calculation. Like, they're not going to respond in the same rational sense. Sure, they may use rationality to say, hey, let's sit out Donald Trump's tenure, or hey, let's change tactics for a few years. But they're not going to turn around suddenly and say, you know what, actually our country is going to be more peaceful and secure if we join the international community and we make friends with Israel and we sign a trade deal with them. That is fundamentally not in the Iranian regime's DNA. So they're not going to change from that perspective. We are watching as well for this aggressive Iran from a biblically prophetic perspective. And that, I think, is something that it's just been really remarkable to see, where they've really gotten this beating and it's not changed them. And they are still this same pushy power that is described in the Bible.
Yes, you're describing Daniel 11, verse 40, which describes two power blocks in the time of the end, a king of the north and the king of the south, that clash. And since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief has identified radical Islam led by Iran. So Iran plus his proxies, as we see, they're pretty good at creating proxy empires, forming this bloc against what would be Catholic Europe, according to not just what we've said, but if you look at biblical or secular history, you could trace, see why that is the case. But I do think it's also interesting, although Iran, like you said, is fundamentally not changing, there is a lot that still has to happen for Iran to fulfill its role in the king of the king of the south. Verse 41 mentions the glorious land. The war is over Israel, over Jerusalem. That is not changing. That has always been a goal of Iran. But you do see, I guess you could say, a shift in tactic. If you put the whole context, say, with the other verses in the passage that talk about some of Iran's allies all being in Africa, Iran has a presence in there right now, but that's not where the main thrust of the spear is. Something has to happen where Iran loses its proxy empire in the north, which there's other prophecies like Psalm 83 that talk about that, for it to change tactic. And also something has to happen for Iran's mentality to have a different target in mind, in this case, Europe. You mentioned, again, a German citizen just got executed by Iran. We're starting to see Europe get dragged more and more into the foray. We don't know exactly how this war is going to finish this particular phase, I guess you could say, of the conflict. We don't know what the dust is going to look like when it settles, but something has to happen in Iran's psyche that makes it radically change course. And this war, I think, has already done that to a major degree, in that it's seeing Israel is growing in power. Its current strategy isn't working, and something's going to have to change.
This is why now is a great time for you, our viewer, listener, to read that book, The King of the South, because it really is your guide to what is happening in the Middle East right now. Because this whole region is changing very quickly to conform with what is prophesied in Daniel chapter 11. You know, I think, Mahalia, you put it pretty well, where you talked about, yeah, there are aspects of Daniel 11, more than aspects, key planks of Daniel 11 that we see already, the pushy attitude, the fight over Jerusalem, lots of that. But the alliance is described in Daniel chapter 11. That's not there in the precise configuration. And you see it changing based on world events right now. So yeah, our booklet, The King of the South, goes over this in much more detail. But there's a couple of prophecies that you can put together. And it shows that Israel has allies of its own in the Middle East. And those allies include Lebanon and Syria, countries that have been very firmly under Iran's thumb until recently. We're watching those being broken out of Iran's grip right now. Israel is in Lebanon dismantling Hezbollah right now. Syria is sitting there desperately trying to stay out of Israel's sights. Hassan Nasrallah was taken off air on Syria. They stopped broadcasting his speeches even before he was killed. Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, is reportedly telling his military commanders, don't shelter Hezbollah troops, don't help Hezbollah, don't help transport weapons to them. They don't want to be in Israel's crosshairs. They're distancing themselves from Iran. At the same time, Daniel 11 talks about Egypt being on Iran's side. And this is, I think, what we're seeing already with Egypt. Okay, we've been kicked out of Syria, we've been kicked out of Lebanon, or we're suffering setbacks. We need new avenues to attack Egypt. And so you have Iran's deputy foreign minister going to Egypt, talking to the Egyptian government. I think this is the first time in many years that you've had an Egyptian leader on that level going into and talking to the Egyptians. That relationship Iran is working to rebuild right now. And you see all of these events reconfiguring in exactly the way that Daniel 11 says they will. So I think if you read that book, if you study that book, you have some very exciting times ahead of you as you watch the Bible come to life before your eyes. And all of these events written down 2,500 years ago, playing out in your headlines. And that's something that can help make all of your Bible study dramatic and exciting. And so now is a great time to read that book. And I think that's a key takeaway from this event. Also, this break with the United States that we've talked about is another, I think, key takeaway and another major fulfilled prophecy that we're seeing from these events.
Well, everything that I just described, if this was, I like to say, if you take the news, cut out Israel and plop in instead any other country that the U.S. has a relationship with, like if the U.S. was taking satellite imagery of South Korean troops and sending it to Kim Jong-un, like that would probably be enough to put a nail in the coffin in the election.
Right, or taking photos of Ukrainian troops and giving it to Putin.
Yes, exactly. You don't see that with Israel. And everything that I describe is the tip of the iceberg. We, time after time again, whether it's giving aid to Gaza that somehow coincidentally ends up in Hamas's hands, or in some cases, like for, say, Britain and Canada, resuming funding of UNRWA, even though it's very clear that they're helping sponsor Hamas. There is something in, I guess you could say, the general liberal leftist mindset, but especially coming from the current government in Washington and tracing its root back to its parent administration, the Barack Obama administration, coming from there, that not only does not like Israel, but that goes actively out of its way to basically be a national security threat to Israel. And what we've been pointing to time and time again is a prophecy in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 14, verses 26 to 27, discuss a bitter affliction falling on Israel to the point where if God didn't intervene, the name of Israel would be blotted out. Now, this is talking a lot more than just the Jewish state in the Middle East, as our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, could elaborate on. But verse 28 specifically mentions Judah being in the midst of all of this. And I mean, it's the state of Israel. The name of Israel is on that little country. Like, in a sense, go figure why it's such a big target of everything going on. And again, it's not the only, I guess you could say, target of what's going on attacking this name of Israel, but it certainly is a big part of the puzzle. And the King of the South also elaborates on that, specifically chapter 2 of that book, which talks about Barack Obama going back to his early days all the way to now, what's going on with the United States attacking Israel, the deeper spiritual implications of it, and what fundamentally it means from the perspective of the Bible and the plan of God.
So that's the book King of the South. We would be very happy to send you your own free copy, or you can read that online. You just go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and if you go to the literature tab at the top right, I think then if you go and do the drop-down menu that says showcase and go to all, you can find it there. We'll put a link straight to that book in the show notes for this show. You can read it online, like I said, or you can order your own free print copy and we ship it to you for free anywhere in the world. There's no follow-up. There's no us pressuring you to try and come to services with us or anything like that. We just send you the book, and we would be very happy to do that so that you can study that alongside your Bible and really bring your Bible to life. Thank you for joining us, Mihailo. That's about it for today. Thanks to George Haddad for engineering and production. If you have any comments, please email us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please do like, subscribe, or comment on our YouTube or Rumble channels. All of that helps us get this out to more people. And we'll be back on Friday with our regular Week in Review show. Until then, keep watching your world.